but it is my great pleasure to welcome back, once again, our good friend of many rivers, the author of these many books and more. Some of them have actually sold already, so you can't even see them, or see the covers today. But this is his new book, Coming Home to Who You Are. Dave Rico is a psychotherapist. He studied for the priesthood, I believe, and has a background that has led him. I should mention also his interest in poetry, and I'm hoping he'll even grace us with a poem or two this evening, because he is a wonderful reader of poetry, as few people are these days. But he's going to be talking about this new book, Coming Home to Who You Are, and we are delighted to have you back. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for showing up, and it's always a really enjoyable thing for me to come here, and I always welcome the questions, so as I'm speaking, just raise your hand when you have a question. We'll do it that way instead of having them all at the end. So my book is Coming Home to Who You Are, and the reason for this title, see, it says as a subtitle, Discovering Your Natural Capacity for Love, Integrity, and Compassion. And the premise that I'm basing my book on integrity and loving kindness on is that we already have these within us, and it's just a matter of knowing how to open up these wonderful gifts that come as standard equipment in the human psyche. And of course, we also have a shadow side. We can do some pretty mean and rude things at times. Not you, but other people. But we do have this wonderful love, compassion, and integrity inside. And this book I wrote to help show how to release it. So it's not how to make yourself someone of love and integrity, but how to acknowledge and proclaim it in your behavior. So that's the point of my book. And just quickly, I'll mention the parts. I start with how would you show love to yourself, and then how do you cultivate your integrity? How do you become as real as you can be? Showing love and integrity in your relationships with others, advancing in the art of intimacy in relationships, and then finally reaching out beyond ourselves to the wider world. So this will be an overall picture of the various sectors in our life experience. One sector is, how am I toward myself? Another is, how am I toward a special person? Another is, how am I toward the people in my life? And how am I toward the people that I will never see? And somehow we can establish all those relationships and bring integrity and loving kindness to them. So that's my basic concept. I thought if I could begin with just reading a page or so from the introduction. This gives you a sense of where the book comes from. In my work over the years as a therapist and in my own life experience, I have noticed that the healthier people become psychologically, the more goodness do they show. So becoming well is becoming good. As it were. And it also works in reverse. When you make a commitment to act with loving kindness and integrity through a spiritual practice or through a 12-step program or just because this is who you are, many of the psychological issues that you've been carrying around no longer weigh as heavily on you. And we can dedicate ourselves to practices of integrity and love and soon notice ourselves becoming healthier, as I was just saying. Our behavior is no longer based on childhood conditioning or on primitive attitudes, but on our now more evolved spiritual consciousness. We have no way of guaranteeing that anyone will treat us with integrity and loving kindness, even if we treat them this way. But now nothing can stop us from giving our personal guarantee that we will act with integrity and loving kindness toward everyone. And this becomes such a source of joy that we settle more easily into the world just as it is, with all its shadow arrows coming at us. This love is a direct path to the unconditional yes, the courageous stance of opening to whatever arises in our lives, of not shutting down in the face of life's challenges. Personally, I still believe, even after all the grim events of our recent history, that we humans can trust that we are inherently a pure goodness, consciousness, and bliss. They reside and are always able to arise in every one of us. They never go away. They can't be lost in the dark. We do not have to search for this light. We just keep making choices for uprightness and love, and soon we will be deeply feeling and gladly sharing the good news that light is our true nature and love is how we show it. Virginia Woolf, in her novel The Waves, shows us what will soon wonderfully happen. And this is a quote from Virginia Woolf. Things are losing their hardness. Now even my body lets the light through. Imagine having that happen. And I end with a quotation from Oliver Wendell Holmes, who in the early 1900s was in the Supreme Court. This is a speech he gave to the Harvard Law School Association. I think it not improbable that a human, like the grub that prepares a chamber for the winged thing it never has seen but is to be, that a human may have cosmic destinies that he does not understand. So just as the little caterpillar, he doesn't picture someday I'm going to have beautiful wings, that we're like that. We just don't know what we could blossom into. And I'm trying to show in this that there are actual commitments that you can make. And I give 36 commitments in here, some of which I'll mention, that really help us change our way of living. Everybody make sense of this? So let me give just a couple of examples, and then we can open it up for discussion or get the basic idea. So I have one chapter on our sense of humor. Healthy humor, now making a distinction, healthy humor pokes fun at human foibles and ironic contradictions, especially our own. But humor can also be negative. So the negative side of humor is sarcasm, ridicule, teasing, mocking, demeaning others, prejudicial jokes about individuals or groups. Even when this is meant to be all in fun, it is hurtful language and not part of the repertory of those committed to loving style of speech. So we can decide, this is our commitment, we can decide not to engage in or to listen approvingly to negative humor. So our assertiveness will help us in this if we can speak up about our discomfort about jokes that show hatred or bigotry. We maintain custody over what we say so that we do not hurt or humiliate others. We are then making loving kindness more important than how entertaining we can be. And often that entertaining way of being is meant to get us to be part of the in-group. But when you're acting with integrity, that would no longer matter because you want to come from a loving place. So this would be the commitment. At the end of each chapter, I give the actual commitment, which is like an extended affirmation. I have a sense of humor, but not at the expense of others. I do not laugh at people's mistakes, distresses, or misfortunes. I feel compassion and look for ways to be supportive. I am less and less apt to engage in ridicule or sarcasm. I forego using comebacks when others are sarcastic toward me. Imagine giving that up also. Not only are you not being sarcastic, but no comebacks. Just sit silently, beaming out Buddhist compassion. I forego using comebacks. I seek simply to feel the pain in both of us and look for ways to bring more mutual respect into our communication. So that's just one example. Each chapter is something like this. It takes some feature of life. I'll use the example of anger also, because that's one that we all can relate to. And shows that there is a way of coming from the light and love rather than from the shadow side, which is also often our natural habit. So what's happened is when sarcasm and ridicule are part of our style, we have closed down the sector of our humor that would come from integrity and love, and we've replaced it with the more primitive style. Does this make sense to everybody? Mm-hmm. And of course, with each of these, you would want to do them with no expectation that other people will even notice this about you. You're not trying to look good. And when they don't come across in the same way, you're not judgmental. You simply notice as a witness and aspire that they would see the light. Does this make sense to everybody?
Yes.
Any questions about this part of it? Yes, way in the back. And your name is?
My name is Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Yeah, when you say you're not judgmental.
Yeah.
What if you are?
Okay, let me make the distinction between an intelligent and obvious assessment simply notices where something is unskillful. A judgment makes people wrong and bad. That's the difference. And wants to get back at them for it. See how that would come from a part of our psyche that was never colonized by spiritual masters? It's still coming from caveman times. But that's a good question. Everybody see the distinction? In fact, that is another one of the chapters, the difference between assessing and criticizing. And many of us were criticized so much in childhood, we got used to just taking it and then we started doing it to others. Ingrained habits that we never consciously looked at and said to ourselves, does this really fit with who I am? Is this becoming to me to be like this?
Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. What you were just saying, and the question was really good when I think about judgment, the nature of judgment.
Yeah.
And your answer was interesting to me, too, because for me, it makes me think of when we look at something as a judgment, or if we judge, I should say, we're coming from a place of being injured.
Yes.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Oh. I was saying that for me, when they were talking about judging, and the difference between judgment and an intelligent assessment, to me reminds me of when I judge, I am feeling hurt. Whereas if I simply make an assessment, there's no injury involved.
Yes.
That's a big
difference.
That's
a very good
me.
Distinction. Mm-hmm. She's saying you come from an injured place when the judgment happens.
Yeah, then
and
I want
also
to step back.
You injure others when
and
you judge them.
Back. Right.
Yeah. None of these would ever work if they depended on anybody else. I'm going to wait till everybody else is like this, then I'll do this. No, that would never go.
No.
That's why this is so courageous. Because, oh, I've decided to live this way, and as I say in the introduction, something about... hold on one sec. I just have this here. That these are not strategies to get you anywhere. They're commitments that we're making just because this is who we really are. Who am I really? The same as what St. John said about God. God is love. That would be this. That was our identity too. Other questions about this? Yes.
Well, that distinction is very useful between intelligent assessment and judgment coming from a state and
yeah.
place. But is the implication that if you bear witness to that distinction, watch yourself, and actually have that commitment to staying away from
mm-hmm.
judgment,
mm-hmm.
that that's actually going to affect your behavior or feeling?
Hopefully.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. I notice that's not always the case.
When yeah, know. Yeah, I know what you mean. Other, yes, you are Michael. Hi.
You look at the relationship between judgment and blame, and how blame can often leap out as a knee-jerk response to being hurt.
Yes.
And that blame is kind of an addictive response. It's kind of a drug. And it can reflect in an addictive place, an addictive mentality. Do you look at addiction?
Yes, I do.
In terms of emotional qualities and emotional response. And
I'm glad you brought this up because I do see it this way. It's almost as if we have a compulsion to judge, and as we've been judged over the years. And a lot of what the ego does, the untutored, inflated, scared ego, not the healthy ego, comes from compulsion. Like you just automatically do it, and then it becomes an addiction because it becomes habitual. So I'll say a little more about the criticism since somebody brought it up. It is natural for us to assess people and their behavior. So you can't stop your mind from doing that, and there's nothing wrong with it. Like you assess a movie, for instance. Intelligent discernment is a skill of the healthy ego, so everybody needs to have this skill. It can be distinguished from pejorative judgment, which happens when we censure, blame, or look down on others, will have that element in it of elitism. That tendency is something we can work on. Here is an example. We have a friend who we believe is overly controlling in his behavior toward us. We are mindful as we keep coming back to the pure reality of his behavior, controlling, but free of our inclination to condemn or criticize. Simply notice it. We then open ourselves to compassion. We recognize controlling behavior as a compulsion, which is what it is, form of OCD, being controlling. It's an illness. They're not just being controlling because they want to get their way. They're being controlling because they can't help it. We recognize controlling behavior as a compulsion, a misunderstanding of power. This way of thinking, a misunderstanding of power. See how different this is from what's wrong with him? Why is he so controlling? A fear of spontaneity. How compassionate this sounds. We say, may he let go of controlling. This is you speaking about one of your relatives. May he let go of controlling and thereby find his true spiritual powers. May I not judge others, but assess and bless. May all people find this path of freedom from fear. We can further work on our tendency towards censorious judgment. That would be the negative. By becoming aware of three common dangers in communication. What I call the CIA. Criticizing others, and notice how our parents did this to us. Criticizing others, interfering in our lives, and giving us advice when we didn't ask for it. This applies especially to how we relate to our family members and our partner. We imagine that we are being of help when we do this, but it may be that we rush to these CIA responses because we're not yet comfortable with simply being with others in their predicaments and feelings. We want to get them fixed fast. And our practice then becomes remaining present to those who tell us about their problems with no attempts to fix or intervene, but with a kindly openness to their quandary and all the feelings around it. We were not treated this way, most of us. They weren't being present and welcoming our feelings. They were telling us, do this and then that won't happen. Stop doing this and then that will happen. So we didn't have models that helped us know how to access the healthy natural impulse inside. Instead, that was closed off and was this is what got substituted for it. So from this I come up with my commitment. I look at other people and their choices with discernment, but without censure. I still notice the shortcomings of others and of myself, but now I see them as facts to deal with rather than flaws to be condemned. I avoid criticizing, interfering, or giving advice that is not asked for. And I avoid those who use this CIA approach to me while nonetheless holding them in my circle of love. So the way to love yourself is when you notice that somebody's like this all the time toward you, you're going to limit the contact, even family members, because this is not healthy for your psyche. And you still hold them with love, but less contact. As I sometimes say to my clients, and they say, my mother called from New Hampshire and she starts criticizing me and she just can't help it. I say there's a simple technique to use. All you have to say, just interrupt and say, "Oh my God, look at the time." "I'll call you next week, Mother." Does this seem cruel?
No.
Seems very sensible to me. Eventually they might get it that, "Oh gee, he always rushes off as soon as they start to sense it." Yes, you are?
Lauren.
Hi, Lauren.
I am interested, what you said struck me. It's like you just approach it with compassion. And then I hear you saying about these commitments. So my question is, how would you advise to develop compassion?
Okay. The point of this is that compassion is naturally in us, but over the years it's been covered up or mishandled. And through a series of commitments, you can restore yourself to your original settings. What are these original settings? Our Buddha nature, our enlightened, actual, true nature, not the ego that's been built up over the years out of fear and the need to separate from others. So the compassion is not pity, in which you feel sorry for the person who is so critical or who you think is to blame for something. It isn't like a one down. I'm up here and I'm looking down on this person who is so messed up. It isn't like that. It's more of the idea of that I attune myself to the fear behind those statements, and I automatically feel a sympathy for them, and that makes me have this compassionate style instead of pity. Does this make sense? Somebody else? Yes, and you are?
I'm Anne.
Hi, Anne.
Hi. From what you're saying, I think that it's really good thought to bring to bear on ourselves and for greater awareness. But it seems like in the moment when you're in a relationship with someone, and it's maybe hard to step back and just be kind of Buddha nature, and you're relating,
yes,
and you feel this judgment come up, this criticism come up, and it seems like that feeling can block communication in the moment, and that you might have to cop to it or something, say, "Well, I'm feeling critical." I mean, to just swallow it at that point seems like it could be a block.
Yes. I like what you're saying. And we all have that as an issue. Not just you. I mean, that's natural. So this would have something to do with... I have one in here on admitting our failures. So I just want to respond with this concept. Once we start making these commitments to integrity and loving kindness, we keep a better eye on ourselves. We're willing to admit it when we notice that we're not living up to these commitments. Mm-hmm. If we see that we have just lied, attempt to manipulate, or acted in a selfish or unkind way, as soon as we notice it, we own up to it. This is hard to do. It's going to take humility. But once we're on this path, we'll do anything to come from this loving place. So we become open about our motives, no matter how embarrassing. For example, we might stop ourselves in mid-sentence and admit to somebody, "Don't be fooled by my manner. I'm acting as if I were definite and on top of things, but in reality, I doubt myself." Imagine saying that. Or we might say, "I asked you if you wanted to go to the movies with me, not only because I enjoy your company, but because I'm lonely." Imagine saying that. See, you're humbling yourself because your commitment to the truth about yourself has become more important than how good you look to the other person. Such a ruthlessly candid confession increases our humility and winsomeness, lovability. Such honest self-presentation and others' appreciation of it comes to matter more than how well we have hidden our true motives. Imagine being like this. But you can be. Eventually we will trust ourselves so much, trust is really what's behind the whole issue, and find such delight in being authentic that we will want everything we do to reveal us. Imagine that, no matter what the reactions or consequences. Reminds me of that prayer in the Episcopal service. O God, to whom all hearts are open, all desires known, and from whom no secrets are hid. Imagine being that kind of a person, that you would want to be like that. We will then become aware of the extent of our goodness, because we were invincible in the face of fear of being known. So this is the affirmation that flows from it. More and more I blow the whistle on myself when I notice that I'm being phony, aggressive, or manipulative. I want to come clean right then and there by admitting that I'm acting falsely. I am transparent in choosing to be more authentic and consistent in all my relationships. Now I more easily and willingly apologize when necessary. How about getting to that point in life? Instead of defending how right I am, how justified. So a lot of this has to do with letting go of that ego, which is a hard one for anyone. Other questions about this?
Hey,
yes.
I think
you're Michael.
Den. D-E-N. I think for me that distinction on telling on myself is roomier. Like there's more room for me to be by owning that part.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's not driving me if I can just own it. It just gets included with the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah,
all of it. You know what I mean? Like it's roomier instead of like, there's nothing really to lose. It doesn't feel like a loss. It feels like a gain because there's like a relaxation that comes with that. Humbling, but there's more room. Is my experience.
I like that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
You know
you're
I mean?
Right. You can relax because you don't have to try to hide something.
Yeah, that's a full-time gig.
Yeah.
You know,
so
I mean,
saying
no
something
rest.
Like, "You're right. I was being selfish. I really want to work on that in myself. I apologize."
Space shows
creates
up,
creates
right?
More space. Yes.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And other people like you more when you're like this, which is not the motive. We're not doing this to be liked. We're doing this because we want finally to show these qualities that have always been sitting in us but didn't get their chance to emerge.
Hi, David.
Hi, you're...
Oh, my name's Rocky.
Hi, Rocky.
I've admired you from afar.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It seems to me that a theme that I hear you speak about in your work is letting go. And you just mentioned it here, and that's challenging. And I wonder if you have any tips or techniques for being able to let go. And I guess I'm talking about everything, because in some of the CDs that I've listened to you talk about letting go of everything, and I'm assuming you mean everything when you say everything.
Right.
So,
yes, and so you're reminding me of a quotation from Master Eckhart, everything is meant to be let go of, that the soul may stand in unhampered nothingness. Imagine having that as your desire. I want to let go of everything so that my soulful presence will stand in the world completely unhindered and unhampered by my ego. Connects with a statement of William Blake, the great mystic poet of the West. I must let go of everything, lest my soul be found unannihilate and I be handed over to my own empty self. So it's like they're all trying to say that, you know, there's something about letting go of that ego that helps us find our spiritual path. Make sense? So, Rocky's question. Why is it so difficult to let go? I think it's because of the controlling that we're mostly engaging in, and the belief that I have to hold on to everything, I have to keep everything in my grasp. If I let go, everything will fall apart. Instead of, if I let go and everything falls apart, I'll be left there standing, and I'll know what path to take. So that would be a different way of looking at it. Also, we're afraid of letting go because it means grief. Because something you were holding on to for dear life is suddenly gone, and you're going to be forced to go into mourning, which nobody wants to do. So it's related to controlling and grieving, and it's hard for all of us. Other questions about this?
If you don't mind.
Yes, go ahead.
One of the things I've come to understand is the importance of attachment, especially in early life. And so here we are attached.
Yes.
And now we've got this idea of letting go.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of seems confusing to me.
The letting go comes from... The reason the letting go makes sense is because of the Buddhist teaching about impermanence. Everything will be continually changing and ending. That's one of the givens of life. So the style of letting go fits with the way the laws of the universe work. They don't work on the basis of everything will stay the same. Today I was with Jim looking at a Japanese maple, which was, of course, green. And he said, oh, in another month or so, all those leaves will be red. And I thought to myself, oh yes, they'll be red, then yellow, then they will fall. Because that's the nature of a maple. And then they'll come back in the spring. So the style of continually letting go, oh, I have to let go of the green, now let go of the red, now let go of the yellow. And we'd be doing that all over the place if we lived in accord with nature. But instead, we're trying to hold on to everything.
Well, and I want to know that the spring is going to come back.
Yeah, it definitely will.
Thank you.
I also like the image of a multi-stage rocket, and you have to release one stage, and you're not even sure if there's another stage.
Mm.
It's going to fire behind it.
Yes.
So there's trust, and there's a learning.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the most active learning waiting for you?
Yeah.
In the moment.
Okay, I just wanted to say a word about the letting go, because that's one of my chapters. Reacting defensively is a trait of the ego. When it's frightened about losing its primacy or its control, I don't want to take my place in line. I have to be first. Such defensiveness is a major obstacle to authentic intimacy. And letting go means that I would discard my arrogant belief in my own entitlements. I don't get a special deal here. I'm like all the other humans. Anything can happen to me. And my affirmation for this one is, I know I can never give up on my labor of love. To keep winning my ego back from its misguided tendency to hold on, inflate, defend, and highlight itself, that's how it loses its chance to find the love it so desperately craves, but also fears. That's where it comes from, that all that controlling stuff. It comes from the part of us that desperately craves the exact same thing that it is terrified by.
I'm not sure I understand how someone could crave love, did you say, and be afraid of it at the same time.
You could say, she says, how could you desire love but also fear it? Once you see the kind of presence that true love requires, once you see the amount of giving up of ego that it requires, that's what makes it terrifying. Once you get past the honeymoon romantic phase of it, and you see, oh, this is going to take a lot of working things out with somebody, that's scary. This is going to take a lot of having somebody mean so much to me that if he or she should leave, I'm going to be completely devastated. Do I really want that?
That's more attachment than love. I mean, to me, love is...
Oh, I see. You're saying if it were real love, it wouldn't be scary.
Right.
Yes.
That's what unconditional
love means. Yes, I agree.
Without fear.
Yes. That makes sense. Yeah, this is the love in the context of ego attachments. Okay, I wanted to mention one other example. This is about the various influences that are at work in our lives. We can choose to become particularly alert to the omnipresent influences of the three main streets that direct so many of our attitudes and lifestyle. Madison Avenue, Wall Street, Hollywood Boulevard. We can work on becoming less materialistic by remaining aware of how Madison Avenue advertising industry seeks to make us want what they say we have to have. We can enjoy entertainment, but notice that Hollywood may commandeer us into espousing superficial or unenlightened values such as glamour, extravagance, and thrills. Moving away from these three streets we choose instead to take our stand where the boulevards of mindfulness and loving kindness meet. There we have let go of the need to grab and hold, which is often our style, grab and hold, even in relationships. Because pomp and promise cannot seduce us to want more and more. Becoming more sincere and more loving has become the more we seek, instead of the more that Madison Avenue wants us to see. On that corner, free of vanity, we dress as we choose, not compelled to sport the latest fashion unless we genuinely like it. We arrive in the vehicle that fits our needs rather than the one that makes the biggest impression. We choose the restaurant where we find wholesome food, not the trendy one where we want to be seen. I wrote this when I was in San Francisco.
Doesn't apply to us.
No, it doesn't apply here. We have all we need just as we are. Our practice of loving kindness toward all the squatters on the three main streets is our aspiration that all of us someday cherish goodness over goods or glitz. And this kindly concern has canceled any envy we might have and turns our hearts toward compassion without smugness, disdain, or a sense of superiority. So when we notice the people who are caught up in that lifestyle, we're not looking down on them. We're just saying, oh, okay, they chose that. So our affirmation is, I can now measure my success by how much steadfast love I have, not by how much I have in the bank, how much I achieve in business, or how glamorous my life is. Wholesomeness and love are becoming more vital, rewarding, and exciting than anything I could gain from things, money, or thrills. See how this would take a lot to really believe in? I'm aware of that. So that's why it takes practices and commitments to release what's inside. But remember that there's something inside that wants to come to the fore, that all these wonderful qualities want to appear. They're not being pulled out by force. They just are waiting for the chance to come out because this is who we really are. Yes? Oh. Anybody else? Okay.
Yeah. Is there a way to, some measure to keep the ego out of this thing of being good? you know, there's kind of nothing worse than a do-gooder or, you know, somebody that just kind of flaunting ego in the process, or you get hung up on ego of being good and doing the right thing. You know what I mean?
You mean you could build your ego when you notice that you're becoming a nicer person? Or
yeah. How do you,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully.
Sometimes other people seem like that's what they're doing. You know, they're
yeah.
Goody but goodies, I guess.
That wouldn't really be sincere.
Okay.
Isn't it a little dangerous to disavow your shadow self?
Certainly, yes. One of the chapters.
Come back and bite you.
Yes, one of the chapters is on acknowledging our shadow side and trying to make friends with it. Because every quality that we think of as negative, I'll give an example, actually has another side to the coin that's of great value. So let's take controlling, which is one we've talked about. That's just one side of the coin. The other side of controlling is the ability to get things done. The ability to coordinate. Leadership. All of that is just on the other side of the controlling. So when you befriend your shadow side, you take those wonderful qualities that support the controlling and you bring them to the fore. So what are the good things that are behind the controlling that I can present to the world? Okay, let's have one last question and then we're going to wind up. Oh, we have actually three. We have one person who didn't ask. Okay, go ahead.
Mine isn't a question. I was just going to say I had no idea why I just need to be here tonight. I just left Hollywood, just packed up and Hollywood came. I'm trying to find what you were talking about because it just hit me right when you said that.
It's in the it's in the chapter about influences.
Okay.
Thank you. And this wasn't meant to put it down. It's just that
it
could influence us to.
Yeah.
My question is around the subject of triggers, getting one's buttons pushed, as it relates to living a good life and being mindful. Because when you are triggered, it seems, when I am triggered, it seems like all of that goes out the window and I respond automatically.
Maybe I see
come
the
back and clean it up later.
Yeah, I see the triggers as based on three possibilities. Sometimes we're triggered by what's really true of us, but the other person's getting away with it. That's the shadow. Sometimes we're triggered by something from our childhood that this reminds us of. And sometimes we're triggered by our ego that becomes indignant by the way people treat us. So now we can go to our last question.
Okay. You mentioned OCD and as an illness as opposed to a desire to be that way.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little more about that? It is a family member that's really thick in it and knows that's what describes it and been diagnosed that, but it's really hard to work with. In terms of just the behavior is so and I don't know enough about it is what I'm saying.
He's saying sometimes people are compulsive and it's hard to work with it.
Well, I mean, this person is aware of the diagnosis, but doesn't seem to like slow it down at all and is very emotionally stormy, constantly triggered and reactive and mean and angry and like that.
Yeah. And so this would be an example of where therapy comes in to the picture?
Deep in therapy, the person is.
Oh, okay. And it's still not changing?
No. And what you said earlier about, you know, not trying to fix and not trying to adjust and just being present for it really is what I'm working with, but anything else you got to say would be great. I need all the help I can get.
Just that it would be good to recognize this as a form of pain.
Yeah.
They're really in pain, which is why they're like that. They're not doing it because they're trying to get the better of you. They just can't help it. That's the nature of a compulsion. That word in Latin means to be pushed in a certain direction. And your own recognition of that, I mean, you don't want to be at the effect of it. You don't want to let people harm you, but you do want to recognize that it's a form of pain.
And fear?
Yeah, fear is part of it. If you have other questions, maybe you could see me right after.
Can I just make a quick comment on that?
Oh, okay, yes.
Thank you.
I'm trained in trauma healing and nervous system and how biology works. And from that perspective, that would be that is wiring your nervous system. Mm-hmm. The reason it's so hard to change is because it's in the nervous system. And so it can be very effective to approach it from that angle.
Yeah, so every cell of our body is reacting to something from the past. Sometimes that's part of it. Well, I'd like to end with this short poem by Edwin Markham. which I think says a lot about the topic we've been on. They drew a circle to shut me out. They called me heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle and brought them in. Thank you.